Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Spark.
We tell true stories.
We tell them live.
And we tell them across the UK.
Tonight we'll hear tales about migration
as part of our collaboration with the Migration Collective.
Here's our first storyteller, Daniel.
Hi everyone. I'm going to talk to you about assumptions, and if this all goes according to plan, hopefully also talk about absolute joy. I've worked with refugees for about 15 years, only here in England, and it's my profession, and I like to think that I don't make assumptions, that I meet everyone and, you know, just go with it and see what happens. And that's nonsense. For the first time in November, I actually went and worked with refugees in another country. I went to a place called Inofita, which is near Athens. It's a refugee camp. And it was mostly people from Afghanistan that were there. And about a month before we went over, there was a group of about 12 of us. We'd gone to actually decorate the camp. It's in an old industrial unit, so we just took loads of paint and brushes, and we're going to just make the place more beautiful. And about a month before we went, some conference in Brussels decided that Afghanistan is a safe country, if you can believe that. So all these people in the camp couldn't go back to Afghanistan because the Taliban is resurgent, and they can't come here, which is where most people wanted to come to, because they're stopped at all the borders. And so my big assumption when I got there was that I would probably be speaking to men because of my stereotypes and my limited knowledge about the culture, about Islam, about Afghanistan. And I thought that's probably going to happen. I'm going to talk to the men. And actually, when I got there, I pretty much talked to no one because I don't speak any Farsi and hardly anyone spoke any English. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? I'm the son of a painter decorator. Maybe I'll just start painting. So I started painting, and after a couple of hours, school broke out, and all the kids ran into the room where I was painting. It was the kitchen, and just started wanting to grab paintbrushes and paint. And I had this thing in my head over and over again. I still dream of it. Me, colour, which we just kind of heard for days. And I was in this thing of, like, on one hand, I want to really involve these children and really encourage them. And on the other hand, I don't want this place to just be splattered with paint. I don't want children to be fighting and covered with paint and all this kind of stuff. And it was interesting. After a couple of hours of this, I noticed this girl of about 10, her name was Asma, I found out later on, and she was just painting beautifully, much better than me, beautiful, clean lines. Everything was perfect. She was washing the brushes. She was cleaning some more. And we started talking as I was trying to, like, fend off these kids but also do the right thing. And after about 2 hours of kind of talking a little bit, she said to me, in perfect English, she said, "Daniel, stop for a moment. I just need to teach you something." Yeah, and I'm thinking, wow, this is incredible. Taliban, young woman, talking to me, perfect English. Turned out she'd only been in the camp for 3 months, and her English was absolutely spot on. And she said, repeat after me. And I apologize to anyone in here who speaks Farsi, because I'll probably sound terrible. But she said, repeat after me, "Badazu." And I made a hash of it. No, "Badazu, Badazu." And she said, okay, say that. And I'm like, well, what are you telling me? And she said, just say it when the next person comes along. And I go, "Badazu." And the kids, like, nod, and they go away, like, with a big smile on their face. And all she taught me was after lunch. And essentially, Asma had bought me time to figure out a plan, because I was kind of freaking out a little bit, me with 15 years experience working with refugees, slightly less with paint. So anyway, flash forward a couple of days, and it was really interesting. The men were really slow to get involved in this painting exercise. Ultimately, what happened is a lot of artists were in the camp and engineers, and the beautiful things started to appear on the walls. We were just going to make it nice, but they murals, everything, it's beautiful. And if you get the chance, there's going to be an exhibition from Saturday at St. Ethelburga's in Liverpool Street, if you know that place. So check it out on the website. And so I noticed that it was women and girls that were coming out and wanting to get involved much more than men. It took the men 3 days, women and girls, like, really quickly. A couple of days after this, I get invited to play football with the teenage girls and some of the female volunteers that I was working with. And it was really interesting. Outside the camp, there was this kind of gritty gravel surface with a handball court, and it was always the men that were out there. It was like the evening activity. Women nowhere to be seen when this was going on. So we took about, they took about 3 or 4 goes to try and get this football match started. And what would tend to happen was that young men would come out and want to get involved, a lot of them wearing football shirts, mostly Barcelona, and doing the kind of fancy footwork, which I have no idea about, but you know the whole trick thing. And it just didn't work because they were kind of off on their own mission and not really playing with anyone else. And I'll never forget this teenage girl who just picked up the ball and just walked off so deliberately, like, if you're not going to play with us, then it ain't going to happen. And finally we had this game, and it was just absolutely joyful. It was terrible. All of us were terrible as footballers. I got knocked down by, I think, a 14-year-old in this kind of great ego-crushing moment. And I just couldn't believe it. When I thought about everything that I know about the world and everything that I thought I knew about Afghanistan, that my mind was just completely blown by this experience. So I think it was 2 days before we left. We were there for a week. And by this point, the camp is just this absolute riot of colour and kind of different forms of expression, a lot about home, a lot about journeys, a lot about hope. And on the penultimate day, there were 12 of us in our group, and we got invited by one of the families of the teenage girls that I play football with to come and have lunch with them. And earlier that day, I'd actually been in the warehouse. I took a day off from painting, and I was handing out to the different families, who incidentally, sometimes 6 people in a room, 2 meters by 2 meters, handing out food to them. And, you know, really just like measuring like a small bit of rice, you know, a family of 6, you know, 12 tea bags for a week, that kind of thing. So we were invited for lunch, and all of us sat down outside this tent, and just so much food. And the father of the family said to us in that moment, he said, "We don't have much food in this tent, but we have a lot of love." And we all kind of lost it at that point a little bit. And so it was just, for me, just a feeling of absolute joy, and just thinking about who I am and the decisions I make daily in this mad city of ours. And something that came up when Omar was speaking earlier on, and he was saying about just go out and be friendly to people, speak to people on the way home. I don't want to sound didactic, but there's a big part of me that wants to say, get out your biggest cooking pot and actually just start making some food and get to know people and get involved, get to know people who've come from another country who aren't settled and aren't comfortable yet, and just have dinner together. That's it. Thanks.
I'm going to bring on the next storyteller. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome for the wonderful Banke, ladies and gentlemen, all the way from the front row. Here she is.
So I think I learned pretty early in life that there were generally 3 categories of migrants, and these aren't scientific categories, so feel free to completely ignore this. But there's expats, there's immigrants, and there's refugees. And refugees tend to be from very war-torn, horrible situation that they had to escape from. The other 2 definitions are very scientific, so I need everybody to pay close attention. If you're an expat, it generally means you're perceived as white, And if you are an immigrant, you're perceived as not white. When I was 4 years old, my family moved from Nigeria to the Netherlands. And to us, we weren't migrants at all. My dad was moving there for 4 years for work. That was the only reason we were there. And in 4 years, we were going to move back. But we moved to a very small town called Assen. And they'd never seen black people before. They'd never met any Africans. And when we first moved there, the neighbors were terrified. Over the years, they warmed to us, and we developed very close friendships. And some of them even came to visit Nigeria when we moved back. A few years later, when I was 16, I moved to the United States and went to college, worked for a few years, and went to law school. So when I moved to Holland, my sisters and I couldn't even speak English, and we learned English very quickly at a British school. And had some kind of weird expat British accent. We moved back to Nigeria and I had the same accent. Moved to America and tried to integrate as quickly as possible with an American accent. The thing I learned in England, for most of my life, an accent was an aspirational thing. It was something that you chose to do, and you went forward, and you learned it, and you spoke in whatever accent you wanted. Since moving to England, apparently an accent is something that you're born with, and you have to stick with for the rest of your life. When I moved to England, I went to college, law school, and then I moved to London to be a lawyer. And as soon as I moved here, I discovered that the categories of immigrants or migrants had nothing to do with the color of your skin, but it was more about what accent you had. And because I'm a very smart woman, I decided that I was going to be American. And British people tend to treat Americans with a great deal of respect and curiosity. So that worked out very well for me. The funny thing about it is I've now been in England for 6 years and I have a British passport now, but it wasn't something I ever intended to do. I've never moved anywhere with the intention of staying there forever. So even moving here was because I wanted to move back to Nigeria eventually, but I wanted to work somewhere where I could get international work experience that I could take back with me. And even though I've stayed here longer in the city of London, longer than I've ever stayed in any city of my life, it hasn't been easy. Like, London is the first place in my entire life, despite how people acted when I first moved to the Netherlands and how people acted when I was like an oddball at a university in America. London is the first place that I've heard myself referred to as the N-word twice. The funny thing about London is probably the place that I've paid the most taxes and been the most active in terms of citizenry. But I've also just had some of the most amazing experiences here. And I've decided that my favorite kind of people are the people when you ask them, where are you from? And they pause and they don't know how to explain where they're from. And that's definitely me. Because when someone asks me, where are you from? Especially after we've already been in conversation, I want to know why. I'm like, are you asking me because of my name? Or are you asking me because of my accent? Or are you asking me where my passport is from? Because it's all very different stories. And for the most part, I've felt that London was home because it had the greatest collection of people who were from everywhere. And you can go out every night in London and meet someone from a different country. But I think in recent times with Brexit and with the theme or the feeling from other parts of Europe, it's the first time in my life where I felt like London is part of a bigger country that may not be as welcoming as London itself is. And perhaps London is only welcoming because it does have the biggest collection of people from everywhere, or people who don't even have like a very direct story about where it is that they're from. I think when I got my British passport, I decided I was going to go back to my Nigerian accent and just not talk in an American accent anymore. But after Brexit, I thought maybe I'll hold on to it for a little bit longer. It's kind of home now. Nigeria will always be home as well. I don't know what the moral of the story should be. I don't think I ever got to that part in thinking about this. But there are different kinds of migrants, and no one type of migrant is better or worse than the other. And there's nothing you can tell about a person from looking at the person, or even knowing what their job is and knowing how much they're contributing to your society. But I mean, the world, London, England, America, Nigeria doesn't belong to you because you won the ovarian lottery and landed in a place that didn't have as many issues as another place. It's just the world, and we're all have every right to every place that you could possibly find yourself as each other. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Spark True Stories.
If you love what we do,
please help us spread the word
by leaving us a review on iTunes.
For more true stories
and to see a live event,
head to stories.co.uk.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.